Hello.
Benjamin Law.
Beverly Wang.
Hey, what's going on? What are you up to?
So I've just spent the last half hour trying to get that Google Arts and Culture app to stop telling me my selfies look like the exact same Malaysian artwork, even if some of the subjects in the artwork are women. No luck so far. You?
Lol, you can't escape your fate, Benjamin Law. Anyway, yes, thanks for asking. I need help. I'm up to my eyeballs in Aziz Ansari and Me Too think pieces, and I still can't make up my mind what I think about all this. So that's actually why I called. I need you to help me debrief on this.
Yeah, I've been obsessing over this story too, and I'm really conflicted. You're right, we absolutely need to talk about it. Hang up now, I'll meet you in the studio. Stop everything.
And here we are. Hi, I'm Beverly Wang, and what a thrill to be kicking off Stop Everything, our new pop culture show. We're part of the Hub family, RN's expanded arts and culture offering.
And I'm Benjamin Law, and every week we'll be on air and in your Stop Everything podcast feed with interviews, analysis, and recommendations. So be sure to subscribe now on the ABC Listen app or search for Stop Everything wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes, you know, our interests, our tastes, our momentary obsessions. I think you're with me, Ben, when I say that all this stuff that we consume tells us a lot about ourselves and our wider culture.
Totally, B-Wang. When we dissect pop culture, we are taking the temperature on politics, society, the world around us. And a huge conversation at the moment, of course, is hashtag Me Too. Everyone's talking about it, including Oprah.
And I'm especially proud and inspired by all the women who have felt strong enough and empowered enough to speak up and share their personal stories. So I want tonight to express gratitude to all the women who have endured years of abuse and assault because they, like my mother, had children to feed and bills to pay and dreams to pursue.
That was possible presidential candidate Oprah Winfrey there at this year's Golden Globes. And that conversation brings us to Aziz Ansari. We do need to talk about this. Aziz Ansari is an incredibly popular and well-known American actor, comedian, and author. His most famous TV role is Tom Haverford on Parks and Recreation. And he's also the co-creator and star of the Netflix series Master of None, which has been a critical TV hit. Early this month, he won a Golden Globe for his work on the show. And in so many ways, he's been a darling of progressive causes, leading conversations about issues like on-screen diversity, growing up as an ethnic minority in America, and the complications of modern romance, which makes the collision between him and the Me Too movement quite uncomfortable.
Totally. And at the Golden Globes, he really put his Time's Up support on show. He had a button on his lapel. Time's Up is the fund for women who've been sexually assaulted or harassed in the workplace. More than that, though, Aziz Ansari is really, he's a leading man who's built his career by positioning himself as a counterpoint to toxic masculinity. And that has come through in his TV work and in his stand-up. He actually wrote a book about modern dating. Here he is on late-night television talking about feminism.
My girlfriend has influence on me. She's a big feminist, and, you know, that made me think about those kind of issues. I'm a feminist as well. Any feminists here clap? Any people feminists? If you look up feminist in the dictionary, it just means someone who believes men and women have equal rights. And I feel like everyone here believes men and women have equal rights, yeah?
So I think a lot of people, myself included, were surprised when an article came out published by a relatively obscure website called Babe with a very detailed account of a young woman's retelling of a date where she went on a date with Aziz Ansari where she felt pressured to have sex. Now, it's important to note that she left the date, they didn't have sex, and Ansari called her a car. And he apologized the day after their date when she raised it with him and repeated it in a statement after the story was published. But the reactions to the story have been deeply divided, and there have been many of them.
Yeah, I have to confess, Ben, I want to talk about this story. I think it's really necessary to talk about it. But I also have trepidations about tackling it because opinions are so polarized. There's been a lot of positive reception to the story, and there's been a backlash. And then there has been a backlash to the backlash. We will post a few links to some of those articles on the Stop Everything homepage in case you're curious, including the original post by Babe, the website. So anyway, to be honest, I see a lot of gray. Mm. I have a lot of questions. I'm a little bit nervous because this conversation is so charged that I think sometimes even admitting to seeing gray areas in the story is a contentious position. But the beauty of this situation is that I am the host. I get to handball it to Dr. Lauren Rosewarne. She is with the University of Melbourne, and she writes and lectures about media, pop culture. She's our regular panelist. Hi, Lauren.
Hello.
G'day, Lauren. So the Me Too hashtag rose to prominence originally, I think, last October after the Harvey Weinstein story broke. And then by December, there were prominent whistleblowers who were declared Time Magazine's Person of the Year. So does this kind of indicate, this conversation still rolling on, that hashtag MeToo is here to stay?
Yeah, I think it's become more than just the hashtag, but the hashtag was what we were all fearing would die. That the idea of, you know, Kony 2002, that it was going to die a quick death and that there wouldn't be any measurable consequences. What we've seen now, there have been scalps. And I think that is an interesting measurable effect of what looked like it was just going to be a flash in the pan social media campaign that now several months on is still going strong.
Beverly mentioned before that there have been, with the Aziz Ansari story at least, there's been backlash to the backlash. What about the movement itself? Have we seen kind of a backlash building against the Me Too movement yet?
Look, I think it's tricky to talk about movement singular because there's lots of things happening. There's public policy being happening. There's training courses in individual employers happening. I think that what we need to think about is this idea of how do we measure change, but also how do we then look forward and think, will this actually have measurable impact going forward to the lives of women in workplaces and women in Hollywood as well?
But talking about the ructions about what has been written as a response to the Aziz Ansari story, it strikes me that every powerful movement, you think of Black Lives Matter, you think of a lot of things, there's always going to be internal ructions. Is this just actually a very natural development? Because not everybody is going to be on the same page. There's multiplicity of views and multiplicity of you know, standards and ideas.
But it's our culture now, and there's a cottage industry about people who are producing think pieces to tear holes into any movement or to try and spot the niche that no one else saw. And I think this is a classic example where you're seeing the onion being peeled infinite times to try and find an angle that hasn't yet been exposed, be that why we should defend Aziz or why we should condemn him. And I think that this is the nature of social media publishing and the fact that all writers need to find some into the story that hasn't already been spoken about.
Is there a bit of dread these days actually even looking for the think pieces and trying to figure out? I felt like I was drowning. There was one piece and I thought, oh yeah, okay, I identify with that. And then I read the rebuttal to the think piece and then that colors my thinking. And so there's all of these things and I actually feel very confused. And the vitriol that is expressed around, you know, how dare they have this reaction is so much a part of the furniture of these conversations these days. I don't think we can avoid it, but I find it aspects of it quite troubling.
Well, even with the James Franco allegations that have come out against him, you've got these people who've made the allegations but have said, we also need to make sure that you know that James Franco isn't Harvey Weinstein. So at the same time, while they're making the allegations, there are all these caveats to say, look, James Franco, we say is guilty of X, Y, and Z, but he's not a monster like Harvey Weinstein.
And this is the, I guess, my entry point for the Aziz Ansari story and why I'm interested in it. Some of the backlash that I read were things like, well, if that was considered sexual assault, then we've all been sexually assaulted. And my point, which is what I wrote about in my article about this, yes, we have been. We have all had, particular women have all had experiences like this where sexual situations have gotten out of control because no one has stopped to ask whether, do you really want this? And I think that's my interest in this, is the fact that this is such a universal experience for women. And yet we're somehow packaging as though these are one-off stories and somehow connected only to celebrity and somehow there's the fact that celebrities are objectified and sexualized, that that's somehow an industry expectation, as opposed to, no, this is a gendered issue that is near universal.
A lot of the critique of this particular story about Aziz Ansari, published by the website Babe, I think has been muddied because of the way the journalism was done. So the manner it was written, the fact that the young woman was given a pseudonym, kind of the unnecessary focusing on the outfit, her quibbles with what wine she was served, the length of the date, I don't think it did it any favors in trying to establish itself as a serious piece of journalism, especially with establishment journalism, people who came out and gave it a really hard kick to the shins. But if we put that aside and we think about the allegations that Harvey Weinstein has been accused of and Kevin Spacey, I mean, is there a space that we should be giving Aziz Ansari to be given a different reaction?
This is a tricky question. I think partly we want to hear more from him, but if I look at this from a PR perspective, he's better to fade into the background until this story dies down. And the fact that there are so many of these stories coming out, he's got quantity on his side in terms of this is actually going to blur a bit into the background, given that next week we're going to have another handful of these stories. He starts to look a little bit less significant, and then Ben's point about scale becomes relevant again. Well, he's not a Weinstein, that this wasn't, you know, bathrobe antics at the Hyatt, that this is something different, and that this was a date that was misinterpreted as opposed to sexual assault. And I think that grey area is something culturally we have difficulties dealing with, because it's a conversation we all have to look internally and look at our partners and talk about something that's often very raw for a lot of us.
It's interesting that Aziz Ansari didn't show up at the SAG Awards, which followed the Golden Globes, and when his name was called, deathly awkward silence.
Well, I was also about to say that we're talking about a spectrum of behaviour, but in all of this, I guess there's also a spectrum of the quality. I mean, it's an awkward phrase. How do I say it? The quality of the allegations, or the quality of the journalism that brings up the allegations. With the Weinstein case, this was a rigid, disciplined feat of journalism. Two New York Times journalists collaborating with all of the women. An Australian version of that is happening, but we're also starting to see allegations kind of brought up in a more grassroots kind of way, and that can be tricky, right?
And this is where my issue comes in, is I'm all about the day in court. A lot of people, a lot of men are going to lose jobs over these allegations, and at this stage, they're just allegations. But with the other hat on, as a feminist, I know most of these cases never see court. So the idea of victims wanting to get some sort of legitimation of their concern, it doesn't surprise me that they use these channels. But does this look like evidence in any meaningful sense? And then we start talking about quality and veracity, which I think muddies the water further.
What I'm seeing a little bit is a lot of older women, and part of me identifies with this, is not understanding possibly that the rules of the game or the rules of engagement, whatever they may be, for young millennial women who strongly identify with this article have changed and morphed to the point that maybe the older women don't actually understand the rules of engagement in that dating space anymore.
And this is my hesitation of criticism of the article, that it focused on details such as clothing. Why can we not support women telling their story on their own terms? And I think this is a tricky point for us, because I think I'm not at my age going to relate to that article. For me, of course, I had criticisms of it. And I want to also understand why you'd mention details that rape myth fighters have been fighting for so long to not talk about. You've stirred in clothing and wine into the discussion. But the audience for Babe, it's not me. It's those young, late teens, early 20s women who are going to relate to that story, who are going to relate to the idea of sex happening with someone that they've only had minimal contact with online, potentially on the first date. How do they navigate consent? How do they navigate sexual boundaries? And this is certainly what journalists have been ringing in talking to me about, because I've written about this convergence of sexuality and new technology. How do young people navigate this without the cognitive skills that someone 10 years older
but
might?
I remember on a university campus getting those skills, or getting that message, you know, really hammered into me. People were there was so much sexual health and education outreach. So where is that? I understand what you're saying, but are we actually talking about the fact that we need a third branch now where, okay, so there's a very unhealthy thing going on about conversations about consent or lack of conversations. This is the reality. Let's acknowledge it. What do we do now to actually strengthen and help these young women?
But this is a shortcoming of having education around consent versus what happens in that bedroom or in that lounge room where you're actually having to navigate hormones and apprehensions at the one time. Suddenly, that seminar that I heard in O Week doesn't actually feel that personal and that much of a skill for me.
When you hear someone like Germaine Greer talk about the hashtag MeToo movement, her reservation saying, you know, women of my generation, we were just told to fight back, does it place just too much onus on the individual and on women when the problem is, you know, dudes?
But it's a misunderstanding of the notion of when consent gets to be articulated. We have this culture that wants, well, when did no get said? Well, hang on, was I in a position to be able to say no? Was I ever asked a question where no could be articulated? And there's many ways to express dissent without that two-letter word.
So where to from here, especially in the Australian context? We've also got a legal system where our defamation laws are really robust. We've had our own cases here, some prosecuted quite forcefully and others strangely. What's the Australian news story from here on in?
This is so tricky. I think more conversations, but also, which of course I'm going to advocate, but also more dialogue around this concept of sexual scripts and about these expectations for both men and women and how the intercourse narrative plays out, because I think we don't do a good enough job acknowledging that.
This is Stop Everything, your stop for all things pop culture on RN and in your podcast feed. I'm Beverly Wang with Lauren Rosewarne.
And me, Benjamin Law. You can find all of us on Twitter using our handles or the hashtag StopEverything.
So we'll post a wealth of Aziz Ansari think pieces on the Stop Everything website. Go to abc.net.au/RN. Search for the hub, search for Stop Everything. You will find us. But we really can't just kind of whistle past the fact that our program, our beautiful new program, is kicking off on what has become a very contested and politicized date, Australia Day, the 26th of January. And in the pop culture realm, the big change this year has been that Triple J has moved its Hottest 100 countdown by a day from the 26th to the 27th of January.
It's a conversation that's been bubbling here at the ABC for a few years. Will Triple J change the date of the Hottest 100 or not? And now that it's a reality, it has changed, what actually happened? Is it political correctness gone mad? Or is it an overdue recognition of January 26th as a problematic day to celebrate? Or is it just practical management? Well, culture wars and radio ratings intersecting means that space will not be left empty. Yes, into the vacuum. Melbourne station Triple M announced it would roll out its Ozzest 100 celebrating Australian music.
Yes, here are a couple of songs that probably wouldn't make it into a 2018 musical countdown otherwise. And you say, that's Savage Gardens, To the Moon and Back, and of course, Down Under, Men at Work. Those tracks are both on Australian Conservative Senator Corey Bernardi's AC 100 Spotify playlist. Here he is chatting about that playlist with RN Summer Breakfast presenter Hamish McDonald.
Why are these songs that we all enjoy for you to appropriate for your political purposes?
Well, they're not appropriated for my political purposes at all. They are,
Senator, you called it the AC 100.
And would it make a difference if I called it Corey's 100?
No, they're both associated with you.
Oh, so here we go. So all of a sudden, I'm not allowed to create a playlist on a music streaming service for which I subscribe because I might be politicising it. This is nonsensical.
So as far as I can tell, neither countdown has a public voting component. So in terms of being a measure of taste, trends, popularity, contest, that's totally null and void, right? And then it brings me to my second thought of, I can't help but wonder, is this actually a small test case of be careful what you ask for when you agitate for a change of date?
Because this seems to be like a practical decision from the ABC, right, Lauren, that, look, there's a lot of debate building up around this. Why don't we just water it down and do something sensible here? But of course, there's been such a vocal backlash. Should that have been anticipated?
It's tricky. You know, the Top 100 has become this sort of metonym for a left-right divide on this issue. I think there's an interesting question about just because something has always been done on a certain date, we have this argument we need huge reason to change it. Why do we need huge reason to keep it? I think this idea of Can we tap into the zeitgeist? Can we tap into the debate? Not necessarily come out one side or the other, but just say, let's move this out of a political discussion and make it about the music, which was what it was supposed to be.
Well, interesting to note, obviously, the Hottest 100 hasn't been held always on the 26th, only since the late 80s, I think. And I'm going to put my big corporate ABC hat on and say that it was never conceived of as an Australia Day celebration. It just happened to be a public holiday where they decided they'd play some music.
And the ABC doesn't seem to be, it's not, of course, challenging January 26th as Australia Day, but what they're doing is that they're actually saying it actually frees up their space to be able to celebrate Australia Day as its own event. And what was interesting was that the public process around this was quite engaged with the listeners. As much as the Hottest 100 is engaging listeners, the decision around this engaged listeners too. So there were 64,990 responses to a survey about the countdown, and 60% of respondents wanted it moved.
But isn't that the almost a beautiful illustration, actually, not almost, definitely, a beautiful illustration of the ABC knowing its audience, but Triple M knowing its audience as well. Mm. And I think we shouldn't remove, you had the corporate hat on before. I don't think we should remove the corporate nature of this decision as well. Both stations know their market.
Mm. Yeah. And so just a little touch on fun things we did over the summer holidays. So holidays are over. Now it's back to serious, boring times. But okay, so The Gone on SBS. I actually was overseas and did catch up viewing of slow TV.
I love that you caught up on slow TV. You didn't even need to experience it. That's the slowest of slow TV experiences.
So, Ben, Lauren, did you watch this? Did you have any thoughts? Did you love it?
I hate Natural Splendor. So, this isn't a joke. I do not ever appreciate nature. I do not understand who would put themselves through this and watch this for even more than 5 minutes.
Do you appreciate beautiful transport infrastructure, though?
Yeah.
Well, that's actually a very good question. I like that question. I do appreciate, you know, the wonder of machinery. Mm. But for me, this I put this into the category of that channel in the UK that just broadcasts snooker 24 hours a day, and also those channels that show crackling fires and fish tanks to try and soothe people into slumber.
Will there be other Gantu?
Gantu, too fast, too furious. But this actually comes from a bigger movement. It's a Scandinavian concept.
Yeah, they've had wood chopping.
Slow TV. But the one in Norway where they had like a ship going through all the fjords and things, that was like a national event.
Yes.
And Australia seems to have been able to replicate that.
And it's us trying to tap into this idea of mindfulness through television, which I think is quite ironic.
Tantric television.
Okay.
Just as long.
Well, I've had a beautiful time with you, Lauren. Please come back next week. Lauren Rose Warren, thank you so much. She's a writer, a lecturer in media and pop culture at Melbourne University, our regular panelist here on Stop Everything. You can find her on Twitter at Lauren Rose Warren.
Science officer, report.
Captain, it's a wormhole.
It looks really interesting.
It's just too fascinating. We're being dragged in.
So, have you ever fallen down an internet wormhole? It happens to me all the time. I see something on TV, post or story online that piques my interest. Off I go, Googling articles, scrolling through feeds to find out more. Before I know it, I've probably spent an embarrassing amount of time reading up on whoever or whatever I'm temporarily obsessed with.
So my wormhole is, look, I don't watch much sport usually, but my family does go in waves with the tennis, Beverly. And so, you know, a lot of the attention has been fixed on Chung, the Korean tennis player.
Yes.
The first one who's made like the quarterfinal.
Love him.
And I thought that was really fascinating. And then I realized he was playing a guy named, he's literally named Tennis, the American player.
From Tennessee.
Yes, and he has all of this kind of like interesting politics around him that I was not aware of. I fell down this tennis alt-right wormhole, the pro tennis player who is very kind of politically charged right now and has a beef with Serena Williams.
Well, okay, here's my wormhole confession, right?
Mm.
You know, Dwayne Johnson?
Yes, there's a safe space.
Highest paid actor in Hollywood, also pro wrestler known as The Rock. Can you smell what The Rock is cooking?
The huge guy, you know, he was in Baywatch and in, oh, he was like the voice
film
of Moana.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So anyway, I cannot remember exactly why I went down a The Rock wormhole, but can I tell you, firstly, he has a meticulously written Wikipedia page, beautifully written, very well-maintained, detailed
organized
forensic.
Fans.
Yes. But the other thing I did was I ended up reading a lot about his ex-wife, Danny Garcia, as a result of wormholing my way there via Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Who's his wife? Why is she so
interesting? She's amazing. And it's a really interesting detail about their relationship. She's his ex-wife.
Oh.
And she's his manager. She's his business partner. She's probably a huge and key reason why he is the highest paid actor in Hollywood. She's also turned herself into her own powerhouse, Hollywood powerhouse in her own right. So, look, fascinating wormhole-y kind of stuff, right? Ryan Griffin, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey what Ryan. Internet wormholes have you fallen down recently?
Look, I'm always a sucker for a good conspiracy theory wormhole.
Oh.
There's just something fascinating about it. It's not that I get sucked into, you know, the ideas that they're pushing, but more that people are coming up with this. It's almost like it's pure entertainment. Some of these, I love a good flat earther theory of Earth being flat.
And this is really, like, let's clarify. This is actually a movement, right? Like, when I first started seeing the memes, I thought it was being ironic. But there are people out there who really do believe the world is flat.
Yeah, absolutely. There's you know, a few NBA basketball players who constantly peddle the idea of it. You know, there are more and more people jumping on board the idea that it is a massive government cover-up.
So, Ryan, you know, the whole definition of a conspiracy theorist is like they're the most prolific wormholers they are. Like they keep digging down into the internet until they can't dig anymore and they come to this fantastical idea that they really believe in. So have you ever looked at a conspiracy theory, read about it, and kind of been seduced by it yourself?
No, look, I think I wouldn't say I have, but I think, you know, what I get fascinated of is of how plausible they make these theories sound.
So you like 9/11 being an inside job or something like that?
Yeah, like they really deconstruct. You know, if using 9/11 as a theory, they really deconstruct the towers falling and who could be behind it and you know the second plane crash and you know there's so much that they delve into, and you know it's almost marketing genius. They look at it and they find that one thing that could be blurred into their favour and really push that one-sided argument.
Well, look, we have shown you our wormholes. Ryan has shown you his. That sounds very graphic, I know, especially for Aaron in the morning. But we want to hear from you. Tell us what your wormholes are and we might share them right here on Stop Everything. Contact us on social media or on Twitter using the hashtag Stop Everything.
Our email address is thehub@abc.net.au. That means you can write to us, or better yet, if you have a smartphone, and you probably do if you're going down wormholes, find the Recorder app, record a short voice memo with your internet wormhole confession, then email it to us, thehub@abc.net.au. We're also on Facebook, so search for ABCRN's The Hub and leave a response on our post about internet wormholes. This is Stop Everything, your stop for all things pop culture and part of The Hub here on RN on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Beverly Wang.
And I'm Benjamin Law.
And Ryan Griffin, television producer, writer, and creator of Clever Man. You aren't just here to tell us about your internet wormhole deep dive, right? So January 26th, Australia Day. It is our national day, but it is an increasingly contentious date with such a mix of views on whether to change the date, leave it, and also what it signifies to so many people. So even talking about Australia Day has been a cultural pastime in and of itself. Ryan, I wonder, sometimes does it feel like the month of January is just taken over by this conversation? And what's the impact on you?
Look, it's tiring, you know. It's, you know, Aboriginal people are constantly, you know, fighting for our culture throughout the entirety of the year, but it just seems that this month in particular, everything is just ramped up.
Mm.
You know, like it is a constant debate, and you know, you find you know, political figures, activists, all pop their head up around the, you know, the second or third of January, and really start to push this. And you know, for me, it'll never be Australia Day. It's a day of mourning for me, and for many other Aboriginal people. And you know, to even express that and then be hit with such anger that you know that we're expressing these views. It's just tiring.
Right. I was going to say that probably by the 26th, you're looking at the calendar and thinking, when is this over?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's you know, for me and my son, you know, I talk to him a lot about the, you know, the meanings of this day, and you know, we get out of March and then we spend the rest of the day just relaxing.
Mm. I was about to ask you, what exactly does January 26 look like for you? So you attend rallies, and then what does the rest of the day relaxing look like? Do you hang out with your son? You're watching stuff on television?
Yeah, we you know, for me and him, I love, as all parents do, like to force my views and excitement onto our children.
That's your prerogative.
Yeah. So, you know, like we go for the march in the morning, and then we will, you know, I switch off social media, and we'll pick a few TV shows, some films, maybe play some video games, some board games, and then just shut out everything that's going outside the house.
That sounds fun. What do you actually watch? Lead us kind of through your post-rally playlist, or what you intend to watch this January 26th at least.
Right now, me and my son, we watch a lot of Futurama. It's something that we sort of bring up every once in a while. You know, they're not making it anymore, but it is. There's so much to watch, and he really gets into it. You know, it's a big sort of a learning thing for him, because you know there's some really big concepts that they put forward on their show.
Futurama, of course, is the Simpsons, not spin-off, but like sideshow.
Created by the same team.
Exactly right. Here's a little bit of Futurama.
Good news, everyone.
Uh-oh, I don't like the sound of that.
You'll be making a delivery to the planet Trisol.
Here it comes.
A mysterious world in the darkest depths of the Forbidden Zone.
Thank you and good night.
We will usually just pick a season. You know, I've got all the seasons at home, and we'll pick one and we'll run it all the way through.
What do you love about Futurama?
I just think the writing of it is quite amazing. I think it's probably one of the only animated series that you know has almost brought me close to tears. Some of their episodes are just so fascinating in a way that they can put in so much emotional depth within half an hour and really show just connections between one another, whether that be you know, a mutant and a human, or an alien and a human. You know, it's the relationships that they have between each other is amazing.
Now, Ryan, we are talking about January 26th. When it comes to this particular date, a lot of Indigenous Australians regard it as kind of the start of a pretty apocalyptic part of Australian history, and, you know, a dystopian kind of view of the world. It kind of bleeds into the other TV show that you've been watching and that I've been watching as well, right?
Yeah, look, you know, I think for me, one thing that I watch at night is Black Mirror.
This is something that you're not watching with your son? Is that right? How old is your son?
No, my son's 12. There's nothing that I really hold off showing him. Like, if he wanted to watch Black Mirror, I would sit down and watch it with him. Mm. But, you know, that doesn't tickle his fancy in a way. But, like, because I guess for me, a lot of it is when I watch shows that are quite heavy like that with him, it allows us to have the conversation.
Now, Black Mirror, unlike Futurama, is not a comedy. For those of us who haven't been exposed to this Netflix series, how do you describe it?
Look, for me, it's a look into the way society treats technology and how we can manipulate it for benefits, but there is also the quite darker side to it. You know, the fact that it's called Black Mirror, you know, you look at your iPhone when it's switched off, it's a black mirror. It's so in depth in how it delivers all of its messages.
She put us in here.
Mm-hmm. Drink your vodka.
How do we get out?
No, really, drink it. Drink it.
You can't leave.
What?
None of us can.
Okay, Ryan, I've just recently gone to Black Mirror, so I'm coming to you with a bit of a counselling question. I can only really get through 2 episodes maximum before I really feel like I need just to do something else. What do you do? Like, how many episodes are you able to
handle?
Yeah. What do you do afterward?
Look, because they're quite short seasons, so I tend to, you know, just quickly run through a whole season and then and then move on to a, you know, a comedy series or something after it. You know, there are a couple of nice, you know, there's one episode called San Junipero, which is quite a great love story. You know, so there are, you know, the benefits of watching it all the way through, but it is, it's hard content. And I think there's some really, great messages and, you know, in the way of anthologies, each story is just taking you on a whole new journey and telling you something new.
The connection, I think, between the darkness of the content of what you're bringing us and how you feel about the day, I mean, that can't be a coincidence, Ryan. Surely not.
Maybe it isn't. I think it is something that I think in all science fiction or there is a darker side, but really, if you look at it, there's a sign of hope. You know, even if you're watching something that is post-apocalyptic and, you know, the message is if we don't fix things now, this is where we will head. So there is a sign of hope in all these sort of things. So even though, you know, you watch an episode of Black Mirror and you just feel so drained afterwards or you take away just an essence of what they're trying to let the audience know, that's the hope, I guess, that I see in those episodes.
You mentioned that you need a bit of a palate cleanser sometimes, or a bit of comedy between the gravity of a Black Mirror episode. I imagine Rick and Morty might represent that for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, this is probably a good example of some edgy content that that I will watch with my son. You know, it does say a lot of, you know, has a mature content in there, but there's some really deep thought provoking content in there as well. You know, their latest season, you know, dealing with so many of the political movements that are going on around the world at the moment, and they can do it with, you know, a grain of salt, with just lather it with humor is amazing.
It is totally hilarious and dark at the same time. I'm really getting into it as a result of your recommendation, Ryan. So thank you for that. Here's a bit of Rick and Morty.
I turned myself into a pickle, Morty! Boom! Big reveal, I'm a pickle. What do you think about that? I turned myself into a pickle! What are you just staring at me for, bro? I turned myself into a pickle, Morty. I'm Pickle Rick!
It's I don't even know the scenario.
I'm scrambling to think, you know, when you say it ties into like other cultures, is that a commentary on Brexit or something?
Look, that's just brilliant with no context whatsoever, you know. And I think that's what this show does, is it throws these you know, outlandish ideas and concepts, but then find a way to really connect with the relationships between each of the this family dynamic, you know.
And I'm guessing that your son, being 12, would be totally obsessed with everything that Rick and Morty has to offer. How does he take the kind of darker aspects of it? How do you deal with that?
Look, you know, there's times where I'll you know, catch him laughing at jokes that I'm not quite sure that he actually understands. So I'll raise it with him. I'm like, do you know what you're laughing at? And he'll say no. and we'll explain it. You know, I think, you know, he does grasp a lot of the darker stuff. You know, I've raised him on, you know, comics and video games. So, you know, there are moments where, you know, he connects to some of this stuff, and, you know, I've seen him like cry for some scenes, and I'm like, and it's because he's learnt to love these characters as much as they love each other in the show. And he goes on these dark journeys with them.
Well, Ryan Griffin, I'm already a part of the Black Mirror Futurama fan club, but you have just convinced me to start watching Rick and Morty as well. Producer, writer, and creator of the television series, Clever Man, Ryan Griffin, thank you so much for talking to us on Stop Everything.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Benjamin Law.
And I'm Beverly Wang. Okay, Benjamin Law, quickly now, cultural icons who are known by just one name.
Ooh, you know, just off the top of my head, Cher, coming from Mardi Gras later this year. Kylie, Madonna, Beyonce, Björk, Kanye, Seal, Shakira, Oprah, of course.
Kamal?
Oh, Kamal.
You make me feel so young. You make me feel so spring has sprung. And every time I see you, grin. I'm such a happy individual. The moment that you speak, I wanna go play hide and seek. I wanna go and bounce the moon just like a toy balloon.
The unmistakable voice of Kamal. Hello, Kamal, and welcome to Stop Everything.
Thank you very much, Beverly.
It's wonderful to be here. I'm here with Benjamin Law. Now, Kamal, you're an Australian icon, right? Got hit songs.
Well, you say so. I'm not saying that.
I'm just going to go ahead and say it. That's right. I'm going to take that prerogative. You've performed for the Queen. You performed at Carnegie Hall. You've been in television and ad campaigns. Could you ever have imagined such a career when you came to Australia as a teenager in the 1950s from Malaysia?
Well, one of the things you did not mention, which is possibly, in fact, not possibly, without doubt, the greatest 2 minutes of my life was November 16, 2011, meeting and dining with Barack Obama. And that is something that I will live with and cherish for every minute of my life, for the rest of my life.
Let's backtrack a little. How did that come about, Kamal?
Well, there is a gentleman called Senator John Williams. And I, many years ago, did a favor for him. Not a favor. He asked me to perform for the Men's Shed program. You might be familiar with it.
Yes, Men's Wellbeing.
And it was in Inverell, and I went over there and did it. And years passed, and he never forgot what I had done. And then we met again. So when he realized I was an Obama tragic, he made it his mission that I should meet Obama. And I did. And it was just a life affirming moment for me. There was no other minutes of my life quite like it.
Now, Kamal, I know that meeting President Obama sounds like a life defining experience. Another one might have been meeting my mother. I hope you remember this. This was on the Sunshine Coast in the 1990s. I bring that anecdote up because you really have travelled around the country for many, many years. Your work has really been a mainstay of the Australian consciousness. I, you know, sometimes think of you as Australia's baritone laureate. And yet, despite all of this, I mean, for all of the kind of endurance that you've shown with your career, it's been a kind of fascinatingly strange one sometimes. I mean, a lot of your popularity came out from doing Hey, Hey, It's Saturday. How did you kind of balance a singing career with, you know, doing what I imagine were some strange gigs in your time?
Well, it all began when I became conscious of my blackness when I arrived here in 1953. And to overcome that, I played sport. I played cricket for the school, played hockey for the school or the college, King's College. And that didn't improve my social standing in any shape or form. Being black, I thought I was always second rate and I always will be. And out of the blue, in spite of being threatened with deportation in 1958, with a serendipitous meeting with one Rupert Murdoch in the Christmas of 58, life changed. It was just one thing after another. In 1959, I did my first live telecast in Adelaide. And from there, 3 years later, Rupert and Pat, his first wife, moved to Sydney. And they invited me to come to Sydney and do a six-week season at the Hotel Australia. And I thanked them for their irrational generosity. And in doing so, and I said, I hope to meet them again. And Rupert said, where are you going? I said, I'm going back to Adelaide. He said, no, you're going to stay in Sydney. You're going to make it here.
Kamal, you're kind of like the Australian Forrest Gump. You've met and encountered everyone who was kind of prominent and famous in your era.
But there's something that you just said a little while back that I want to pick you up on. You said you still feel like you are in fear. It's hard to fathom that with all your achievements and the longevity of your career, that you still harbor a sense of inferiority or insecurity
belonging?
Or not belonging.
Yeah, it's inferiority or insecurity. It's there, you know, the bottom layer of my consciousness. But, like, for example, if I go into a room full of Anglo-Saxons and people who I don't know, I become very aware of my blackness till I see a friendly face. But it doesn't matter. I mean, it's there.
Have you seen Get Out, Kamal?
Say that again.
The movie Get Out. It's an Oscar-nominated film at the moment that deals with the idea of being the only black person in the room, but takes it to a horror comedy level. It's a fascinating film. Have you been able to catch that at all?
No. Now that you mention it, I'll
we'll have to have you back to get your
sure
thoughts.
I go and see
yes,
it.
Come back and give us your review of Get
yeah,
Out.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing is this: that put it this way, I believe life is all about perception and conception. In other words, whatever we see is very subjective, and whatever we conceive is also subjective. And what I have learned over the, you know, the 60-something years since I've been here, it has been evolving. And what I think today is a far cry from what I believed and feared all those years ago. And it's the people that I have encountered. Some of them have been irrationally generous, like Rupert Murdoch, and one Mrs. Newton, and so many others. It takes too long to mention. And at the same time, there have been others who've been pretty vindictive, and not least among them, the organizers of the bicentenary, and where I felt perhaps the worst insult when I gave them two songs that I cherished and that I didn't actually write it, I conceived it, My Home and What Is Australia to Me. Those rejections to those songs has created a scar deeper than anything else in my life. But ironically, because of the rejection, the other side of the coin was I was invited to sing it for Prince Edward 6 months later, and he liked it so much he told his mum and dad about it. And the following day, I met Prince Philip, and he said, all night I've been hearing about this FBA song and FDA. What is it all about? So I told him, and the FBA is foreign-born Australian, that's me, and FDA is with your friend, Sir Eric Neil. He's a fair dinkum Aussie. I said, these two songs are the two kinds of Australians that make up this country.
Kamal, and your story of your career and the story of that song is a story of resilience and persistence, if nothing else. So thank you so much. We're going to hear that song because you have persisted and you have re-released My Home. Here it is. Thank you, Kamal.
Thank you.
This is my home. This is my country. This is a land I've grown to love. My life began across the ocean, but I belong here, and though I roam, I say Australia, you are my home.
Ben, have you listened to any good podcasts lately?
Well, the one I've got on my phone right now, I'm not sure you've heard of it. It's a really good one about a race in Australia. It's called It's Not a Race.
Oh, Benjamin, thank you for that generous cross-promotion.
I've heard
but
rumors
seriously.
About the host, though.
What else is on your playlist at the moment?
I've got a lot of stuff. Look, I'm always listening to stuff that WNYC is putting out, like the Nanty podcast. I really love another ABC one called Ladies We Need to Talk, which is resting at the moment. But if you haven't heard it, it's pretty good. What about you?
I'm listening to one called Second Wave, which is about the Vietnamese-American experience.
I've heard about that.
Really
yeah,
interesting. I think a lot of Australian Vietnamese people will also relate to that one. And also a true crime one called Dirty John, which is a bit of a hit.
Everyone's listening to that at the
very,
moment,
very
right?
interesting. But we also have Kelly Reardon, head of ABC Audio Studios, here to give us some recommendations. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Kelly.
So much good audio around at the moment, isn't there? People
totally.
Just binging on series left, right and centre. But I thought with the whole interest in Watergate, thanks to the Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep movie, The Post, I don't know if you guys have seen that, but it's a fantastic film that looks back at that Watergate era. I thought I would talk about a podcast that Slate has just put out called Slow Burn. And this is a great sort of deep dive back into what happened in that whole Nixon era. And I think there's a real boom in these sorts of podcasts, this sort of looking back at a historical moment in time. And we've seen this whether it's through Revisionist History, which is the podcast that Malcolm Gladwell does, or whether it's things like Making Oprah that came out about 12 months ago. There's a real thirst, I think, in the community to look back at these moments in history and sort of view them you know, 30, 50 years down the track and think, did we learn anything? You know, and it's not too hard to, I guess, draw some comparisons from the sort of Nixon era to what's going on in America with Trump at the moment. And the other thing I love about this podcast is, you know, if you were sitting in a room going, let's do a podcast that looks back at Watergate, you could sort of say to yourself, let's get, you know, Woodward and Bernstein or, you know, the obvious suspects that were around at the time, lots of journos from the Post to do this podcast. But instead, Slate grabbed a 32-year-old staff writer called Leon Neyfakh, and he looks back at an era that he wasn't around for. And what I think that does is... it means he's not an insider, and so he doesn't have the assumptions that journos at the time and political junkies would have. So he sort of looks back at it through this really different prism.
And Kelly, is that, do you think that's the intended audience? Because I was born in the 80s after Watergate, so my knowledge of it is quite hazy. Do you think, you know, the people who actually do know a little bit about Watergate would get just as much out of it for someone like me who almost knows nothing?
I think that's what's so clever. There's two audiences here. I think if you did live through it, there's so much that's not known about that story still. There are so many things that he's dug up that I think even people at the time didn't realise. And also the podcast goes into the fact that this actually, we look back at this and think this was a really big moment in journalism and in politics. But at the time, you know, it took a very long time for the journalists at the Post and for Walter Cronkite to make this, to make people care about this story. So I think there's a lot that isn't known even from people who lived through it. And then for people like us who weren't around, it's just this immersive deep dive into a fascinating time.
And you mentioned the movie The Post, which has of course been getting a lot of attention with Oscar season. Was this kind of, do you know the back end story? Was this kind of timed in time for the kind of renaissance of interest around this to happen? Or is that just a pure coincidence?
I think it is a coincidence, but what a happy coincidence it's been, because this has been a little while in the making. And I think Slate have been looking at how do you do these sorts of look back in time podcasts. They are the makers of revisionist history as well. And so I think they probably thought, well, we do an episode of revisionist history about Watergate. Actually, no, there's a whole series here that we could do. And I think it's because there's all these moments that you don't know about, like the opening episode Martha, which is about this kind of crazy Southern woman called Martha Mitchell, whose husband was John Mitchell, and he was in charge of the committee to re-elect Nixon, and prior to that had been the Attorney General of the US. So he's a big, he's basically Nixon's right-hand man.
Yeah, Kelly, there's a wonderful description in the narration of the podcast which describes Martha Mitchell as a ferociously anti-communist Lucille Ball. So that's a wonderful description. Here is a little bit of Slow Burn.
As Martha later explained, it was Steve King, the former FBI agent, who had interrupted her call with Helen Thomas.
And this King rushes in and jerked out the telephone.
Like he literally tore the cord out of the wall. That night, Martha was locked in her room, and after trying to climb out through a balcony, she got into some kind of struggle with King and ended up putting her hand through a plate glass patio door. Soon after, Nixon's personal lawyer, Herb Kalmbach, was summoned to the hotel to deal with the rapidly escalating situation. He decided to bring in a doctor, who came over to find Martha desperately upset and shouting things. Things like, "I'm being held a political prisoner," and "I know information." With this, five men held Martha down in her bed while the doctor injected her with a tranquilizer.
So that is a very tantalizing little slice of Slow Burn, the Slate podcast looking at the Watergate story. We'll hear from Kelly again in the next episode of Stop Everything.
Hey, so it's time to stop everything for now, at least. Show's over. What a lot of fun it's been. Shall we do it again next week, B Wang, maybe with Kamal getting in to review Get Out?
I think that is an excellent idea. Let me book it in as soon as we get off air. So, Stop Everything is part of RN's The Hub. You can get in touch on The Hub's Facebook page or send us an email or voice memo. We love voice memos. Our address is thehub@abc.net.au. That's thehub@abc.net.au. Please subscribe to Stop Everything on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on Twitter. Search our names. We're there.
Catch you later.